Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and filmmaker Michael Moore is back with us. And while Michael is always a headliner, you might consider him kind of a warm-up act here today for our 30 Issues in 30 Days segment on whether the General Motors bailout was good for America. We will have President Obama's so-called car czar, Stephen Ratner, later in the program to give his assessment and take your questions and comments. Michael Moore, of course, from Flint, Michigan, first became famous for his movie Roger and Me in 1989 about his attempts to get a meeting with the president of GM at the time, Roger Smith. Michael Moore is in the news this week for launching a fundraising campaign for the Lower Manhattan Islamic Community Center and for receiving this year's John Steinbeck Award from San Jose State University. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you. Let's start with Lower Manhattan. How are you getting involved with that plan?
Well, I just as a citizen watching for a number of weeks, the all the craziness building around it and the all the things being said about a group of people that I just felt like some, you know, not enough of us were standing up and saying, hey, wait, you know, they have a right to build what they want, where they want. It's within the law. It's they passed the zoning commission. It just seemed to be part of a general tone of the sort of angry, sort of bigoted thing that's going on, whether it's with, you know, chunks of the Tea Party or whatever these days. And it just, I don't know, I just as a normal, regular citizen, I just didn't want to stand by anymore and not say anything. And so I said that do I think they have obviously a right to do that, and it's not even my right to even say they have a right. It's just the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, the founding father people.
I've heard of them.
The document didn't give us these rights, and it says that very clearly. The document says that this document exists to acknowledge the rights that already exist, that are inherent in us simply because we are human beings on this earth.
Do you know Imam Rauf and Daisy Khan? You haven't vetted them for
never
the...
Never met them. No. No.
Moore Seal of Cultural Worthiness? Nothing like that?
No. In fact, the first time I saw her was a few weeks ago, and it was on a PBS show or something where she was sitting with the rabbi that is that runs the Jewish Community Center up on Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
And they're talking about how when they had the whole idea for this Islamic Community Center, the first people they went to were the people at the Jewish Community Center and said, can you help us do this because we'd like to do what you do? And so the rabbi there has helped them from the beginning how to structure their organization, how to set up community events, how to do this and that, fundraising, you know, and I just kind of sat there like, wow, how come nobody's told me this? Why am I just seeing this for the first time on some, cable, PBS, something that isn't on the, certainly not on the front page of the New York Post, and that this center was actually being helped by the leadership of the Jewish Community Center. And as I sat there watching this, I just thought, well, first of all, this is the world I want to live in, where people sit down and do things like this together. And why isn't this being supported? And so the attack, I found it bothersome, and I wrote that on my website, and I said to the people who are on my website, and I said, we need to do something here. There's not a whole lot you can do if you live in Omaha, but maybe you can vote by sending a symbolic dollar to their nonprofit foundation to help support them in this.
And do you know how much, if anything, you've generated so far?
I think it's pushing $100,000.
Really?
At this point, yeah. And I had said that I would match it, dollar for dollar up to $10,000. And I thought when I said that, I thought, well, I really won't have to write a check for $10,000 because I can't imagine 10,000 people at this point in this climate, you know, sending a dollar in. And I was pleasantly surprised that it went way, way, way beyond that. That it just the whole thing just offends people's basic American instinct and nature that you just don't do this, and you especially don't do it to a group of people that are in the in one of the smallest minorities, because if you allow the angry mob to get away with it with this group that represents 0.6% of our population, don't be surprised when the angry mob then, when they succeed here, decide to turn their attention to the next smallest group that's right above them or the group after them. That, I mean, that is generally, unfortunately, how humans have behaved throughout history. So I just it was just my attempt to be supportive. I'm surprised at the polls. I think that bothered me too. I think you've seen them, Brian, right, where it says something like 68% of the American public oppose it being built there.
Yes.
And you know, if anything, I said in a you know satirical way that it not only should be that I said I opposed it being built two blocks from Ground Zero. It should be built on Ground Zero, meaning, I mean, obviously, it's not going to be built on Ground Zero, but meaning that 19 murderers who killed 3,000 people and used this religion as their excuse, they didn't just hijack those planes. They hijacked a religion from a group of people who don't believe in what they did. And I think it's our responsibility, for those of us who aren't Muslim, to reach out our hand and to say, hey, we know that. We know that these thugs, you know, did something horrific, and they used your good name to do that. We want to help you. We want to help restore, get back your religion, essentially, in your hands, and what this religion is really about. And so, you know, I can think of no better way to do that than to say, here at this place where Islam was, where it was used in vain, you know, we're going to build something positive with the good people of that faith who make up the vast, vast majority of people of that faith.
Michael Moore, the filmmaker, my guest on WNYC. And I want to go on to something else. We are having Stephen Ratner next hour, who oversaw the auto industry restructuring for President Obama. Did you know that your movie Roger and Me is mentioned in the book?
No, I didn't know that.
Ratner writes here, so I'll deliver the news to you. Ratner writes, the most successful documentary ever at the time, 1989, skewered the company for exporting jobs to Mexico and impoverishing Flint. Detroit's ingrown management culture looked more arrogant than ever on screen. How timely the film was. After the recession of 1990 to 91 forced more layoffs and plant closures, GM earned the grim distinction of recording the largest one-year loss in American corporate history, $23.5 billion in 1990, or was it million? No, billion. In 1992, I don't know, you tell me, did it ever occur to you? So that's the quote. That's pretty much the entire reference to Roger and Me in Stephen Ratner's new book, Overhaul, about the auto industry. Did it ever occur to you as you were making that film in the late 80s that GM might ever come to the taxpayers for a bailout?
No. but I did feel very strongly 20 years ago that they were on the path to ruin, and they were going to bring us down with them. And that's why I made that film. I mean, I living in it there in Flint, Detroit, I felt that this company did not have the best interests of the American people at heart, and they were just being dumb. I mean, this isn't in the film, but one of the things I wanted to do, if I could ever get the chairman to meet with me, was I thought if I could just get him to take a spin around the block in a Honda, just one block, just ride in this thing for one block, you know. Remember, this is 19, you know, the mid 80s, that he would understand why people are starting to buy these cars, and maybe do something to change their culture. But their arrogance was such that, you know, when they said what's good for General Motors is good for the country, they meant it. And they thought, hey, we build it, you buy it, shut up. And you know, a new generation grew up thinking, well, no, I work very hard for this money, and in fact, now we need two incomes in order for the family to function, unlike our parents. And so we're going to be very careful with how we spend our money, and we don't want a close personal relationship with Mr. Goodwrench, where we're having to return the car to the shop every couple months to fix something. And if you owned a Honda, what you knew at the time, and I was one of those people who had bought a Honda, a little Civic, that I had for 9 years and never once took it in the shop for anything that broke down. I mean, I had to, you know, you had to change the tires,
get the tune-ups and stuff.
Yeah. But never, nothing that ever broke down for 9 years.
And, you know, the easy narrative in the media is often that GM failed because it paid its workers too much, and not that that may not have been an issue in the global context, but I think to Ratner's credit, and we'll talk to him about this, he really gives it to GM's management in this book for decades of bad management as he sees it. Capital acquisitions like buying Hummer and Saab, becoming addicted to cashback incentives that sustain production but sacrifice profits. He says he and Obama fired the president of General Motors once the government took over because that president of GM blamed everyone but management for the company's failure. Even afterwards, he says they presented a design for a credible new car when Ratner said their goal should have been not credible but compelling. So he's pretty tough on it. Did you support the GM bailout?
Well, yes and no. I supported only that part of it that would you could not just throw tens of thousands of people out of work, the chaos that would cause to them, to their families, to the country in general would be serious. But to reward a company who had acted in exactly the manner that you just read to me, because that's exactly who they were. The company went down the tubes, not because of its workers. Workers didn't design the cars. Workers didn't have this arrogant attitude. Workers didn't have this sort of, you know, the culture of General Motors was, let's aspire to the mediocre, and that'll be okay. And if you know anything about sports, all you have to do is look at the Detroit Lions, which is owned by the Ford family. And even though they didn't take bailout money, they were part of that same culture that just kept building these cars that nobody wanted. They weren't safe. They weren't fuel efficient. On and on and on. And nobody would listen. And so I made this movie. I didn't know anything about making a movie. I just started making this film in the hopes that, I mean, my big hope was that I could take this around the country and really kind of get people inspired and kind of warn them about what was happening, not just with General Motors, but corporate America in general. And you know, things would change. I mean, that's 20 years ago. That was my naive optimism.
So
it didn't change.
Looking back on GM's abandonment of Flint with 20 years of hindsight, and one of the things we'll talk about with Ratner is, on the other side of the coin, his remorse that they didn't get more concessions out of the union, knowing how precarious the financial stability has actually been. If cars are made so much cheaper in other countries with cheaper labor as the economy has globalized, did GM have much choice but to bargain down wages or move the plants?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, where is it? Why is the law of that says, I mean, the theory that says we should make as much money as we can no matter how we make it? I mean, yes, absolutely. If you want to make things cheaper in China or Mexico, yes, you can make a bigger profit if you go make the cars there. But who's going to be left to buy your cars once you've thrown everybody out of work here? And if your only concern is just to make a profit, if that's really what this is all about, how can we make the most money? Well, why don't you sell crack? Why don't we let them sell crack? The reason we wouldn't let them sell crack, the reason why it's illegal, is because we as a society believe that if we let them sell crack and more people got on crack, we would crumble as a society. Well, we allowed them to ship tens of thousands of jobs overseas, and we crumbled as a society as a result of that. They killed the middle class. The level of all the social problems that came with that, the rise in divorce, alcoholism, drug abuse, everything that comes with losing your job and having your life ripped from you, and we allowed this to, why?
You blame that on General Motors?
Absolutely, and I blame it on our politicians. Why don't we have a law that says, you know what? Just as you cannot remove a national treasure, say the Declaration of Independence, out of the National Archives, you can't sell that because you could make a profit because some Chinese museum would like to have that. We don't allow that because we consider that a national treasure. But somehow we don't consider our own people, our own workers, as a national treasure. Why isn't it illegal to move these jobs elsewhere?
Well, Mike, that would be a restraint of trade.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to talk about homeland security, where's the sense of, and this is the one thing where I disagree with Mr. Ratner about trying to get the, you know, the union should have to accept even deeper cuts. Well, the deeper the cuts means the less money they have, and the less money they have means it's the less things they buy. And if they buy less things, that means the people that make those things, they lose their jobs. You want the workers to have more money, because what do they do with that money? They go and spend it. And when they spend it, then more people get to work.
That's one of the great economic debates of our time. Lower wages and cheaper stuff, or higher wages and more expensive stuff. We got to go in a minute. You're being given a John Steinbeck Award at San Jose State University. I see that the human rights activist Dolores Huerta is a co-honoree. Past winners have been Bruce Springsteen, Arthur Miller, John Sayles, Jackson Brown, Garrison Keillor, Joan Baez, Sean Penn. But many of our listeners have never heard of the Steinbeck Award. So what does it mean to you?
Well, I was very moved to hear this. It's something that is controlled and set up by the Steinbeck family and the Center for Steinbeck Studies out there, and John Steinbeck's son Tom is going to give me the award next month, and it just, I was very moved by it. I mean, it's something I don't really feel that deserving of. I think I've got a few more things I need to do here before you start handing me anything like this. But I guess what I felt was is that for these past 20 years and growing up and living in Flint, Michigan, that I've been a witness to a modern day Grapes of Wrath. And the power of that book and the power of the other books that he wrote, where he spoke about those who were exploited and who were essentially defenseless, that exists perhaps on some level even more these days. And I know we don't have time to get into it now, and I'll come back some other time and talk, but it just that we're not out of the woods, as everybody says, and we're not out of it in a big way. And the rest of the crashes that are about to happen economically, I don't think we're ready for it, and the amount of suffering it's going to cause the average person. What did the average worker do to deserve this? I mean, this is just, and who is, you know, it's like you said, well, the media will say this. Well, the media has an agenda in this. The mainstream media that's owned by these large corporations where they sit on each other's boards. They sat on GM boards. People sat on GM and Ford and Chrysler. They made these lousy decisions, and they just get rewarded with it with our tax dollars. And, you know, I understand why a lot of people are really upset and why this election may go south for the Democrats here in a few weeks, which is too bad because, you know, the only thing I read from Mr. Ratner's book is what Rahm Emanuel had said about the UAW, where I can't use the word here on the air, but he said, you know, F the UAW. That's Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, talking. If that's their attitude, if that's the Obama administration's attitude toward the workers, well, then don't be surprised if they stay home. Or maybe they'll vote in November, but they're not bringing 10 people with them like they did 2 years ago. And this is a crying shame that we have the chance to now go back to the way it was 2 years ago in the Bush years. The thought of that is just so revolting. And yet, I wonder if the people in the Obama administration will take the responsibility for how they have essentially brought this in part on themselves.
Filmmaker Michael Moore, thanks for coming on.
Brian, thank you so much. God bless you.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC. And I would say we'll be turning around a clip of Michael Moore for when Stephen Ratner comes on later in the show at the top of the hour, who led the auto bailout for President Obama. He has a new book on that, and he will be here in the context of our 30 issues in 30 days. election series. As we ask the question, true or false, the GM bailout was good for America. So that's coming up. But first, we're going to talk about another iconic company going into bankruptcy in the United States, Blockbuster. Stay with us.